Bruce Berger. I teach in the law school out at Valparaiso University, which is in Indiana. There's been a kind of an invasion of people from Valparaiso here the past several weeks, as some of you know. I'm going to start us off tonight with an introduction, and then I will finish with a conclusion. And in the interim, we will have a guest who will deliver a reading from the Qumran scroll. Earlier this week in Bible class, Fred Niedner was talking about the story in Mark 2 where Jesus and his disciples pluck grain on the Sabbath. And of course, they are told at that point by the scribes and Pharisees that that is strictly against the law. Jesus, you'll remember in Mark 2, in his usual laconic way, says, remember that man wasn't made for the Sabbath. Sabbath was made for the man. In other words, he had a different way of interpreting the same text of law than they had been accustomed to interpreting. And we see the same thing very often, and I'm going to give you an example of that later in the evening, in American law, where we start with some kind of a problem, and we decide either through legislation or through the decision of a case or through administrative regulation to solve this problem. In other words, we have a purpose. There is some problem. We are going to try to design a solution. But we start, we never write laws just because we want to write laws. We don't say, well, let's do five today. I know it probably seems like that to a lot of people, but it never starts that way. Law always starts, there's some initiative coming from someone. Maybe it's the whole people, maybe it's a special interest, maybe it's a pet project of a congressman, but it starts with purpose. In both the legislative tradition in this country and the judicial tradition, that purpose immediately gets transcribed somehow into text. And the moment you take a human purpose and try to embed it in text, there is the potential for, down the road, making some serious mistakes. Because what happens is, at some point in time, the text becomes trump. And people stop thinking about the purposes that gave rise to it. And so then all of the conversation is about what do the words mean, or as courts like to say, what is the plain meaning? This was the British tradition. Once they passed the law, once they changed the purpose into text, all that could be argued about was the text. There was never a reference back to what are we doing here? What is this for? What is this about? In 92, I took a group of law students to see the Judicial Council of the House of Lords, which is the equivalent of our Supreme Court. And these were students who had at least 2 years in law school, and we listened to an oral argument that took a half hour. The students could not believe what they were hearing, because there was no talk about policy, there was no talk about purpose, there was no talk about would it make sense, there was talk only about what do these words mean. And what did we say in 1948 that these words mean? And over there, of course, they went all the way back to things like 1648, where they had a written decision on what it meant. There is, of course, a particular danger. Whenever you pay attention just to the text and forget the purpose, we're going to talk a little bit more about that at the end. But now what I'd like to do is to introduce a special guest. As many of you may know, and as some of you may not, I have a twin brother. My name is Bruce Berger, and I followed a career in law. But my twin brother, Brujas Berger, followed a rather odd career. We're never terribly sure about him. He was, from his very early years, let us just say, suspect. We had really very little idea of what it was that went on to his brain. But these last several years, he thinks he's an archaeologist. He thought he was a dentist for several years, and went through the dental phase. He and I have carried on quite a correspondence. I from my hometown, and he from the place where he lives. I'm not going to read his letters to you. They're a little bit difficult to decipher because a crayon, you know, kind of smudges when you put it in the mail. They don't give him anything sharp when he has to write with, so he has to write in crayon. At any rate, he's been working the past several summers with a team of archaeologists. I'm going to let him tell you more about what they found when he comes in. You know, academics are very particular, and we have some around the room who can verify this. They're very particular about their academic garb. They have to have the right headgear with the right color tassel. You know, we wear purple for law. Each discipline has its own color. Many colleges have their own distinct headgear. So Mark Schwain, who went to the University of Chicago, has a University of Chicago very fancy headgear. The people who went to Cambridge had their own. But my brother Brujas' headgear is from his chief discipline in which he got his degree. And I think he'll be here in just 1 minute. Good evening. I'm pleased to be with you here in Holden Village. The talking in public of this material at this delicate time risks my professional life and threatens to trigger a debate within the archaeological community of unparalleled viciousness and scope. Nevertheless, I am impelled to these disclosures by an unremitting commitment to truth, an undying belief in the marketplace of ideas, and a stern note from Susan Briel that I better have something at 6 o'clock. For the past several summers, I have been privileged to work with two of the greatest archaeologists alive today, Dr. Heinz Scholl and Dr. Harlan Pepper. That's right, Dr. Scholl and Dr. Pepper. Why are they laughing? Eschewing the all too easy and time-worn approach of looking for biblical era relics in the Middle East, Dr. Scholl and Dr. Pepper have been concentrating on digs just southeast of Sandusky, Ohio. For one thing, it is much less crowded. You're not always bumping into Margaret Mead every time you turn around. This past August, they hit pay dirt, as Harlan likes to say. In a little unincorporated area southeast of Sandusky called Come On, Ohio, Q-U-M-M-O-N. Unlike the Qumran scrolls, fragments and remnants of which are still being found and must be fitted painstakingly to fit a still incomplete mosaic, the Come On scrolls were found completely intact and integrated whole, unblemished except for a slight nick on the side of the CD-ROM case. This is, in short, the discovery of our age. Just some brief background on these magnificent scientist scholars. Dr. Heinz Scholl, this academic year, is full-time professor of archaeology at the University of Chicago, UCLA, the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater, Baldwin Wallace, Texas Tech, and Pomona Community College. Dr. Pepper is director of the New Jersey State Home for the Theologically Bewildered. To be sure, malcontents upset at having been outmaneuvered by these resourceful professionals will challenge the authenticity of this marvelous manuscript. A few so-called experts, given a sneak preview, are already rehearsing the predictably ungracious, myopic criticism. Okay, so the manuscript seems to have been originally formatted as ASCII text. Big deal. Just as tellingly in the opposite direction, the scroll's case clearly bears the typewritten date Thursday, March 16th, 1288 BC. Take that, Chris. One especially picky sour graper is trying to build an argument for inauthenticity around the musical markings of the Psalms in this text, which alternate between Selah and Da-du-ran-run. Small minds tear down, big minds find scrolls. Alas, all the pressure of this criticism has precipitated something of a falling out between Drs. Scholl and Pepper. This schism was perhaps inevitable due to the fact that Dr. Scholl began by converting the scrolls on a Mac, whereas Dr. Pepper converted them first through WordPerfect in a DOS environment. These were fateful choices. For example, in a short chapter called Daniel, three persons with the unlikely names of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego emerge incredibly from a fiery furnace unhurt. Some of the stories in this manuscript require some faith to believe. Dr. Scholl's account of the utterance of King Nebuchadnezzar, who saw the three emerge from the fiery furnace, is, and I quote, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who delivers his believers, lo, from all manner of death, even death by fire," end quote. Dr. Pepper, on the other hand, renders the exact same text, quote, "Hey dudes, it's Miller time." And the discrepancies in a chapter called Job, the doctors are, by the way, feuding on how to pronounce this name, are themselves proving something of a thicket. In the Scholl account, the title character keeps his faith through death, locusts, famine, etc. In Pepper's account, Job finally goes over to the devil's side when his cable coverage fails during the fourth quarter of the Super Bowl. A few critics jealous of the success of Dr. Scholl and Pepper claim that although the text of the chapter called Song of Solomon may be authentic, the accompanying photographs are A, in very bad taste, and B, proven inauthentic by the fact that on the back of them the word Kodak is stink. Now, I just today was talking with Professors Wongren and Niedner, both of whom are students of great languages, and found that the term Kodak, and I did not know this before, is an amalgam of two old Aramaic words. Ko, meaning the creator of graven images, or we would say today, picture makers, and Dak, meaning having an annual earnings of over $1 billion. So the critics are saying that these things render the Song of Solomon chapter inauthentic. It is sad that serious scholars must endure these petty assaults. It is also sad that Dr. Pepper's announced need to study these pictures with scrupulous scholarly care set the project back several months. But why ask the reader to judge authenticity through secondary criticism when portions of the manuscript can today, for the first time, be released for all to evaluate? I take great pride, and I thank Drs. Scholl and Pepper for letting me do this ahead of the announced date. To read the first published extract, this from the 20th part of the second chapter of the Qumran Scrolls, a chapter which Dr. Scholl, always the European formalist, calls Exodus. Dr. Pepper, on the other hand, whose graduate training was at Cal Berkeley, has it as Blowing Town. After that, the text is roughly the same. Now reading from the text. After Moses had gone up the mountain, God gave these words to Moses on two tablets. I am the Lord your God. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt not make wrongful use of the name of the Lord your God. Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. Honor your father and your mother. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not bear false witness against your neighbor. Thou shalt not covet your neighbor's house, or his spouse, or slave, or ox, or donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. Then God said, this is the law of the Lord. Take these 10 commandments to the people, then return with your brother Aaron. After several moments, Moses returned with Aaron and with his sister Miriam. Here are my brother and sister, Lord, said Moses. You should know that the three of us just completed law school. And God said, how could you so defile yourselves? And Moses said, the economy has not been good. Manna is nice, but come on, how about a little variety? Plus, all this wandering. We were bored. We went to law school. Sue us. Aaron interjected, the people have hired us to represent them to you. And on what you have written and told our brother Moses, our clients have, it turns out, many questions and concerns. Miriam continued, indeed, my clients have deep worries about these Ten Commandments, as you call them. Some matters we are simply not clear on, and others we'd like to negotiate a bit on. And God screamed, negotiate? You want to negotiate with the creator of the universe? Are you serious? These are not 10 suggestions, or 10 guidelines, or 10 goals, or even 10 strategic planning action steps. These are the 10 commandments, the God-blessed 10 commandments. Do you not know that I make the wind to blow, the sun to shine, and the oceans to rage? And Aaron said, posturing is no answer. Lighten up for your own sake. With all due respect, God, how does creating the universe immunize you from listening to our concerns? As a matter of brute fact, creating the universe strictly entails listening to us. And terminology is not critical. We have no objection to whatever you wish to call them. If commandments pleases you, fine. We simply wish to deal with a few issues by toning down some of the more categorical verbiage. Surely these ideas aren't written in stone. And Moses took Aaron aside and whispered something to him. And Aaron turned back to God and said, oh. Sorry, what I meant was, can't these words be changed? Surely you can get more tablets. And Miriam interjected, before we get back to the content of these laws, my clients have great difficulties with the process used here. Where was our input? There is no consensus building going on here. Where was the public discussion, the give and the take? To govern wisely, don't you know you must have the consent of the governed? How will the people ever take ownership of these principles if they feel they have been imposed on them? It's like you're operating with some kind of divine right. This all seems to have been decided at a secret executive session in violation of the Sunshine and Open Meetings Law. How undemocratic this all was, there was no vote. And suddenly, the mountain shook. 10,000 trumpets blasted. Birds stopped, stock still, midair in their flight. Rivers froze to their banks. The earth stopped spinning on its axis. Lutherans stopped bickering. And God said in a powerful voice, I voted! The commandments passed! 2-1. I think, by the way, that that is the proof that this is a sacred Lutheran text. And Aaron continued, much of our problem with these commandments is that they are in conflict with our most deeply held beliefs, which we call the 10 assumptions. For example, your very first one, thou shalt have no other gods before me. That's pretty wide open, don't you think? I mean, somebody might someday interpret that to mean not just Baal or the golden idol, as we're sure you mean, but money or power or fame. Can't we pin that down? And God replied, it means to include all those things. It means that if you put anyone or anything before me, you will have pain. And Miriam said, now, that's just what my brother Aaron was talking about a minute ago. Assumption number one of our 10 assumptions is, quote, we have an absolute right to a pain-free life, end quote. And now this commandment will cause pain. Why are you sending us on this guilt trip? And God said, guilt comes from within. I do not threaten guilt. I threaten condemnation. Pain inheres in wrong human choices. Sin brings pain. Do you not suppose that your sins will weigh on you? And Miriam said, no. We suppose assumption number two. All pain is someone else's fault. That is why, as night follows day, a lawsuit follows pain. And Moses said, getting back to the text, this fifth rule just says, thou shalt not kill. That's it. God said, yes, of course. Isn't it plain enough? And Moses said, well, what about self-defense? What about war? What about insanity? What about killing pests like mosquitoes and locusts or lawyers, asked God? Look, people, these are general principles. You can work out details in the spirit of them. The supply of tablets isn't endless, you know. Wait till I invent paper. Speaking of mosquitoes, Aaron said, our tricky theologians have asked us to ask you whether mosquitoes will go to heaven. And God said, I am not a wasteful God. Heaven for mosquitoes and hell for human beings might easily be combined. And Miriam said sharply, our clients don't like the commandments, especially the sixth one. And I'm going to advise them not to comply unless they want to, unless it feels right to obey the law. And God said, you speak filth, and filth must be flushed down immediately. Where do you think you are, Holding Village? I read from the scroll. I don't write them, I just bring them to you. Moses said, look, let's get down to the basics here. Exactly who are you to issue laws? And a great stillness descended upon the mountain, so great that the three could not breathe. And then God replied in a voice so loud, it shattered the very rock the mountain was made of. I am what I am. The three lawyer siblings were frozen for what seemed to them as lawyers for an eternity. 10 seconds later, Aaron replied, I am what I am? That's responsive? I am what I am? That begs the question by simply restating the major premise as the conclusion. In Latin, that is petitio principia. A college freshman in a logic course could see the flaw in that. Care to try again? And God said, yes, I do. How about this one? You are, but you won't be. And God continued, look, why not stop worrying about all the technicalities? Just trust me, follow me, leave the legal work to me. And Moses said, well, we've discussed that. But both our psychological counselors and daytime TV hosts assure us that such would be the beginning of a dangerous relationship of dependency. We need to become self-reliant and independent and stay out of all relationships which might cause us to trust others or them us. Our third assumption is you can't trust anybody. Our philosophy on dependence is set forth in many books with titles like I'm okay, you're okay. And God said quietly, I've read that book. I'm writing a reply. Well, actually, I'm not writing it. I'm inspiring it. My book will be called Many Things by Many People, but I like to think of its subtitle as I'm okay, you're way out of line. And Moses said, God, while we've got you here, could you answer a few final questions we have? We each have one question. And we may not see you again soon as you are not locked in time as we are. And God replied, yes, that's correct. And when confronted by three lawyers, that is some blessing. There are times when omnipresence is a drag. And Moses asked his question first. Will my people walk in the promised land? And God said, yes, Moses, but not in your lifetime. And Miriam asked, God, will there be a day when members of my gender can be Missouri Synod ministers? And God said, Miriam, there are some questions which, for political reasons, even I do not like to have a position on. But at any rate, Miriam, not in your lifetime. And finally, Aaron asked, God, will final interpretation of the Ten Commandments ever be turned over to members of our profession, the legal profession? And God said, maybe, Aaron, but not in my life. Tomorrow, but for those of you who are leaving the village, don't worry, he goes up and down on a barge. You won't have to deal with him on the boat. Let me give you another example of a case, a kind of a contemporary American problem that has this sort of purpose text sort of difficulty, and just take about maybe 5 minutes to describe it to you, and then we'll open this up for discussion on anything. Maybe we have some pastors and theologians who will enrich the discussion with some ideas of how actually they see law in the Bible and how it differs from our usual conception. This comes from the criminal law. It started in this particular problem was first addressed, obviously it was addressed in many cultures, but in our tradition was addressed in England, and we picked up from England the same idea. And this was the idea of making it a crime for people to form themselves into what we call a conspiracy, which I learned this week means to breathe together. But presumably these people are doing more than breathing together, right? And so what we did was we had a purpose to stop criminal groups. Why? Well, because criminal groups could do a whole lot more damage than individuals working alone. The projects could be bigger, there was strength in numbers, there was division of labor, there were all kind of things, a division of expertise, all kind of things that people, when they got together in a group, could do, more havoc they could wreak than one person acting alone. Or even if we put 30 in a group, we can get some huge multiple of what the 30 each working alone could cost because of all of these other economies that come with groups. That was one problem, the whole problem of strength in numbers. And it wasn't just economic and physical strength, it was also psychological strength. We know that when groups get together, what they can think of and their willingness to stay the course gets stronger and stronger. One person with a criminal enterprise might give it up, but if that person's already part of a group, it's harder and harder to get out. We find that in many sort of non-criminal ways of life as well, with what we call group dynamics, right? Group power. The other problem that was seen was this. When two or more people got together and formed themselves into a group to commit a crime, not only were they more successful with that crime, but history showed us they were very likely to stay together. That is, the combination of persons would become a continuing operation, would be what we call a continuing focal point for crime. I mean, think about it. If organized crime has nothing on their schedule today, what do? They're going to disband? No, they're a group, and they have all of the usual cohesions that keep the group together. So we had this purpose, which was group crime, and it had all of these things under it that made it bad. And we'll just kind of call them sort of division of labor. And then their tendency to continue as criminal groups, maybe accrete other members as they went along and get more and more power. So because we had this, we wrote a text. In England, they would call it a law from the House of Lords. We would call it a statute, and it's in the criminal code of almost every state. And the text would read something like this. An agreement between two or more people for a criminal purpose. Okay. Easy enough to put into words what we wanted, but notice what happens when the cases start to come and people stop thinking about this and begin to look at this. The first kinds of cases were easy enough. A and B agreed to rob a bank, and either they did rob a bank or we stopped them before they did and we convicted both A and B of conspiracy to rob a bank. Simple enough. There always has to be a legal object to a conspiracy. It's a conspiracy to commit murder or robbery or burglary or whatever it is. But we could prosecute them not just for the robbery, but we could also prosecute them for forming into a conspiracy. You see, it's a separate crime. There's really two crimes there, the conspiracy and then the robbery that the conspiracy commits. So we'll call that the A-B problem. A and B, both of them intending to commit the crime of robbery. But now comes the C-D problem. And I want you to imagine, and this happens quite a bit, that while both of them speak to each other as if they are in an agreement to commit a crime, one of them is not. One of them is lying to the other. One of them is working for the government as an undercover person. Right? Happens a lot in the drug trade. Right? And so let's put, by D here, let's put P for police. Let's say D is a policeman trying to find out who's committing the robberies, and so C says, hey, do you want to commit a robbery? And D says, yes, I do. And this way, D is able to get some evidence against C to see what C's bad intentions are. Now, when this case first came up, obviously we cannot convict D for conspiracy because D does not have a criminal mental state. He doesn't mean to rob a bank. He's just fooling, and he can prove that. Right? He better be able to prove that, or we're going to convict him. Right? So he's just fooling, so C's out. Now, can we convict C for conspiracy? Well, you see, the problem for the common law was a conspiracy was an agreement between two or more people. So they first thought there had to be two conspirators at a minimum. Otherwise, the thing didn't seem to make sense to them. And besides, we had other laws that we could get C with. We can get them with the robbery law, or more than likely, we'll get them with the attempted robbery law. Because C will probably do enough pretty soon that he's committed what we call attempted robbery. Other courts didn't see it that way. American courts began to think that we ought to be able to convict C of conspiracy as well. And here's the way the argument went. The argument went, you tell us what's different between C and A and B. A and B both have a bad state of mind. They enter into what looks like an agreement to them. They're willing to do it with others. They're willing to form themselves into a group. Isn't that just what C is? Oh, tough argument, right? What do the courts do? They start looking at the words. There's a hard word, an agreement between two or more people. Can you have an agreement between two people when one of them is only faking agreement? And we'll find cases in 20 or 30 states in which 5 or 7 judges worry about this for 8 pages. About what the word between might mean here. And in many states they said, can't have a conspiracy because it says between. One of the courts dropped in a little footnote, now if the legislation just said by, an agreement by one or more persons, after all he has to think there's someone else to have an agreement, and so, naturally, some legislatures picked that up. And they changed the conspiracy law, so now it reads in those states an agreement by one or more people. or person. They changed, they cleaned up the grammar. But they still understood there had to be sort of two human beings, one of which might be faking, but the other of which was serious. Okay? And so now in those states, C can be convicted of conspiracy. And in fact, we call that doctrine the doctrine of unilateral conspiracy. Like jumbo shrimp. They don't go together, right? It doesn't work. It kind of fries the brain. Now, what has happened? What has happened is the courts made the error I talked about before. Not all of them did. Some states kind of saw their way through this. They paid attention to the text. They started to worry about what between means, what by means, whether you have to have two, whether you have to have one. Go back to the purpose. What kind of criminal group is two people, one of whom's a policeman, getting ready to arrest the other? How's the division of labor going to work there? Why is that group stronger than the ordinary group? And what's the chance that group will continue in crime? You got the people who arrest you right in the group. But what happened is that the imperative and the tendency to look at the text and forget that there's something behind the text that drives it sometimes gets forgotten. By the way, in Britain, they never go over here. The British tradition is to embed it in text and then worry about the text. The American tradition, for the most part, is more, let's get back behind the text. At the same time, it's good because it keeps the law in line with its purposes. On the other hand, it gives the law a bad name because all of you say, I read, and then it turns out it doesn't mean that. So it's frustrating for a lot of people that we will argue about what the statute means. Isn't it in English? But a lot of that argument is because the argument is not really what do these words mean, but what's behind it, what animates it. Let me stop and see what questions people have, either about this, or about law in general, or law in the Bible, or the come on scroll. And Brujas might come back if you want to talk about the scroll.
Well, I immediately thought of our Constitution. Mm-hmm. This principle, I suppose, would bear quite heavily even on the Constitution.
Absolutely. And the Constitution is a remarkably small collection of words. Right? Somebody did this a while ago, but of course it's out of date, is to take the number of words in the Constitution and then find the number of words in judicial opinions trying to interpret those words and strike a ratio. Right? When they wrote the 14th Amendment, for example, they said, nobody shall lose life, liberty, or property except by due process of law. That was the post-Civil War amendment. We're still not sure what that means. That changes every year with the Supreme Court. So the Supreme Court, since it has to interpret the Constitution, finds itself in the position of having to interpret words that don't tell us a whole lot. And they have to kind of continue. The big debate, of course, is do you stay with what's called original intent, with what the framers first meant? Or do you let the meaning of these words evolve as society evolves? Right? And my guess is, my bet is, once we put some examples on the floor, none of you would want to do it either way all the time. There would be cases where you would want to go back to an originalist kind of intent, and there are other cases where you'd want to move along. For example, the First Amendment says, Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of the press. The press is a First Amendment right. Does that include television? Well, I'll tell you what, the framers didn't know about television, and we didn't have television. So do we go back and say, well, they only meant newspapers, they only meant printed media, because that's all they had, so there's no freedom of press if they're electronic? That wouldn't have been a very smart decision, right? So we now have to take the word press and interpret it in light of its purpose. What was its purpose? The full dissemination of information, including the thought we hate. Then it was in the newspapers. Now it's in the newspapers, television, and radio. And television is really fulfilling the First Amendment because they give us a lot of the thought we hate, right? That's what the First Amendment was designed to...
To add to this problem of statutory interpretation, I think, is the fact that legislatures write statutes based on compromise and sometimes will write with particularly fuzzy language so that they can get it through. And it's left to lawyers and courts to try to figure out what did this fuzzy language mean.
So that's a wonderful point. And so many people miss that. They assume the legislature has a very definite thing in mind, and look at the courts going changing it all the time. And actually, if you read the legislative record, you'll see all kind of conversations where one senator goes up and says, well, what does the word warranty mean when you use it, Senator? Do you mean this kind of warranty or that kind of warranty? Well, I don't know, maybe it's that kind. Well, and then three say, well, it's that kind, we're not voting for it. And three others say, well, it's the other kind, we're not voting for it. They say, why don't we just leave it as warranty? And they go, no, all right. And then they make it a problem for the courts. They self-consciously, you're absolutely right, keep it vague. And the interesting thing about that, there's a very positive thing about that. It goes this way. You're most likely, at least this is our commitment to the adversary system, you're most likely to get the best data on two sides of a question when you get it from people who are intensely interested in that particular position. If we tried to make up ahead of time how General Motors would think about this law and how the consumers of automobiles would think about this law, we may miss a lot. But if we pass something that has this kind of vagary to it, generate a case, here come the General Motors lawyers, here come the lawyers for the consumers, they're going to bring all kind of information to bear, and now the court's going to have the benefit of that. So there's always that sense in which intensely interested participants, at least we assume, will bring more and better data to the table to decide these things. When the Supreme Court, I'll get you next, yes, sir, when the Supreme Court, especially in the 60s, the Warren Court, was deciding a lot of these cases that were expanding constitutional rights, people were saying, they're legislating. It's judicial legislation, and all they're supposed to do is interpret the Constitution. How can they legislate? I'll give you one example, the Fourth Amendment. You know what the Fourth Amendment says? No such thing as reasonable. Well, thanks for all the help, framers. Right? You gotta legislate. There's no choice but to legislate because it doesn't tell you. Yes, sir.
Well, it's a departure from this subject, but it occurs to me that when you look at the, let's call it the Sermon on the Mount, for lack of a better expression, that we have a beatitude or a beatitudinal mindset, which Christians today often interpret very legalistically, to the point where you have cultic people who are cutting off their wrists, they're plucking out their eyes, doing stuff like this, because that's what Jesus said, right?
Right.
We've got a problem in terms of hermeneutic here, and I'm interested in how your perspective would look at that in terms of how do we as modern day Christian people, albeit from various perspectives,
yeah.
You've got what we call the right wingers and the left wingers, and right. Everybody else looking at the same text, and of course interpreting from their own political, economic, socioeconomic perspectives.
Right.
It's not an easy task. It's something that theologians will wrestle with, you know, forever. Can you shed some light on that particular part of the law, which is really not the law at all? It's the gospel.
Probably not. But I'll try. First of all, that particular example and some of the entries there in the Sermon on the Mount are very unlike anything we would find in legislation. Legislation never speaks metaphorically, right? It always speaks in sort of straightforward command language. You shall do this, you shall not do this, this is what this means, a lot of definitions, etc. So that particular sermon is to be understood and taken in a different way than positive law usually is. It's probably closer to a constitution in that sense than it is to what we would call a statute, right? It means to set forth a general principle, to give us a particular direction, but it doesn't attempt to write all the regulations under it. And pretty clearly, I think it's meant as a metaphor in the first place, right? And so I would assume a literalist interpretation about plucking the eye out is not what was meant, but I'm not a theologian. Is there any tradition in which that is understood as a literal sort of command other than a metaphorical command?
If there is, it antedates the New Testament. I'm sure of that.
Yeah.
But the dominant school says that this is a collection, you know, of separate sayings that Luke or Matthew sort of put together to form a sermon, a unit, and it was framed by the writer to be a sermon when in fact it wasn't intended, perhaps even by Jesus, to be a sermon. Separate sayings that were isolated and brought together,
right.
You know, and edited. But, you know, that's what makes it so tough, because it appears to be, to the casual reader of the Bible,
right.
You know, that it's a very literalistic, legalistic sort of thing. And we have folks that practice cultically that sort of thing.
Right. And actually, if you think of the Beatitudes and other parts of Sermon on the Mount, juxtapose them with the Ten Commandments, which we just talked about. Those are in ordinary law command language. Thou shalt not, thou shalt not, thou shalt do this. This, of course, is a tradition that says, we're going past the letter here. We're going into the spirit. What does this really mean? What does this mean down deep? Right?
Mm-hmm.
How are you supposed to act? Not just following a lot of commands, but how are you supposed to see yourself? How are you supposed to see your relationship to God? So in that sense, it's much more pervasive than an ordinary legal command.
Yeah.
It's much more pervasive even than a constitutional kind of doctrine, although a constitutional doctrine gets, I guess, a little closer to it than an ordinary statute. Do you have any?
No, I don't. I frankly don't. I was a pastor years ago, and I remember when we preached on that subject, it was always a difficult one to talk about the hermeneutic behind. It was historically conditioned. You know, we have to say something today because today's different than it was back then.
Right. Fred Niener told a story the other day about a student of his at Valparaiso University. Who became so taken with the story of the rich young man, Saladin, he hadn't given to the poor, that he did. He did. And then he had to go home and ask his parents for help because he didn't have it. So they took a very literal interpretation. Martin?
Well, one take on that is that Jesus was pushing the law to its ultimate ramification, that he was pressing the law to what Paul would say later was the taskmaster. A nature of law in order to prove its futility.
Mm-hmm. So it's not just if you kill, it's even if you think to kill.
That's right.
Right.
So you are inescapably bound in law, you are hopelessly captive to it, and you have reached the end of all possibility of satisfying the law. Therefore, you are convicted, you are done, you are dead, you are dead meat, and ready for the gospel.
That's great. Why didn't you say that before I weaseled around here?
Yes, just one comment, a quick question. It seems like when you leave things vague, it allows for flexibility in interpretation later on. In recent years, with the Constitution, for example, there have been movements to amend the Constitution.
Right.
For things like the balanced budget amendment, flag burning,
ERA flag burning,
a number of issues. How do you feel about amending the Constitution? How should that be approached? Cautiously?
Well, the document itself mandates that it be done cautiously. The procedure for getting it amended is very onerous. There has to be widespread agreement about the justice of the new amendment before it gets through. It's both a supermajority at the congressional level and then work at the state houses to get the states to ratify it. So. As I said in the oration on Saturday, by the time you count it up, it's really been changed 11 times. Because a lot of the amendments canceled each other out, all 10 came in together at the beginning. So there's really been only 11 major changes, and some of them are kind of on fairly technical stuff that nobody cares about. So there's really only about 7 or 8 times that anything important that we've summoned up the political will nationwide to get it amended. But, you know, whenever there's an unpopular decision from the Supreme Court interpreting the Constitution, the reason you hear it is because that's the only way to go. Congress can't trump that. The court trumps Congress if they're talking through the Constitution. Do people like that? Roosevelt didn't. You know, he threatened to pack the court because the Constitution, interestingly enough, doesn't say how many justices are on the Supreme Court. So there's 9 of you? Well, if I appoint 33, well, white people, I bet we can outvote you. And you know how that was averted? One justice changed his position in a critical case on all of the social legislation that came from Roosevelt. That was called the switch in time that saved the 9. That was all. Yeah.
On the matter of the Constitution and what it says or was it meant to say, could you give us some of your observations on how we transitioned from a statement which tells me that the government will not establish or prevent the practice of any religion to the point where you can't exercise religion in any public place?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. With the possible exception of the takings clause, which has to do with condemnation, no single subject right now is more confusing at the Supreme Court level. The justices are battling among themselves, especially about the establishment clause. Okay? And it's almost to the point now where the definitions are such that if this is the reach of the Establishment Clause, it goes right up to the boundary of the Free Exercise Clause. That is, the moment you take one step beyond where you're not establishing religion, it turns out you're trampling on somebody else's free exercise of religion. So part of your question I take to be the Establishment Clause, what does it mean when Congress establishes a religion? For example, we're getting a lot of cases now. It used to be, If you wanted to get a government aid, public aid, to go to a school that had a religious affiliation, you couldn't get it because that violated church and state. That's not true anymore. If the government makes available money for people to go to a particular kind of school, in fact, the case was about a school for blind people, And they made this money available through a government program for money for education for the blind. And the court said, if you give that money for people, for blind people to go and study at a secular school, you have to make that money available for them to go and study the same thing at a school that has religious affiliation. So we're beginning to see some more accommodation there. The other part of your question I take to be the kind of separation of church and state problem, right? In other words, religion in public places, in public forums, crosses on the courthouse lawn, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, it's beyond me how that you can say that church and state must be separated. It doesn't address that at all.
Well, no, that's a later decision that sort of talks about the wall of separation, although I think it was Jefferson's phrase initially. I think that was his locution first. I don't want to get us into a debate about separation of church and state, except to say that at least in theory, the protection is just as much for the church as it is for the state. That is, keeping the state out of the church's business is just as much at stake as keeping the church out of the state's business. So, you know, but I understand it's a very controversial area.
Do you have a session coming up on the new legislation, the Religious Liberty Restoration Act? As opposed to the RFRA?
The RFRA, the Religious Freedom? No, I do not have a session.
I mean, there's a new attempt to get around the unconstitutionality of RFRA.
Right. And the folks who were behind RFRA, which is the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, argued unsuccessfully to uphold its constitutionality, as Martin indicates, are trying again. Because the court's decision indicated that it wasn't the whole idea, it was just certain language in there that was creating the problem. So they're going to try to get that amendment again. And that, in broad terms, is a religion-friendly amendment, which will sort of keep the court out of the religious sphere more than currently does. There's our bell. Thank you very much. And my twin brother thanks you.